IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. My name is Rohan Seth. I am joined here with my colleague Manoj Kevalramani. And today we're going to talk about this really interesting development that's been happening on the tech front, but not in the US, in China actually. I recently got the news that that China is planning to nationalize Alibaba Group and Financial. And as soon as I read the headline, my first instinct was to copy and paste this this link to Manoj and ask him to make sense of it for me. Because generally, I've done some reading around Alibaba. I know that Jack Ma has been fairly outspoken and his speeches are quite popular in China and globally. Exhibit A is that conversation he had with Elon Musk at the Global AI conference. I hope I'm getting the name of the event right. And that's sort of where we are right now, because the nationalization of Ant Group and Alibaba is maybe going to be underway, and people haven't seen or heard from Jack Ma in a long time. So Manoj, give me the lowdown on this. What's happening?
Hey, thanks so much, Rohan. Okay, so the first thing first, I remember when you shared this news with me, my response to you was that, you know, I don't think that there's any nationalization going to happen. In the sort of conventional sense of nationalization, government is not going to take over businesses and going to run them. That's really not going to happen, even in China. Yet what we're clearly seeing happen with regard to Alibaba and Ant Financial, and not just them, but also the entire technology sector in China, is that the state seems to be hitting back. The state seems to be framing new rules, which is not really surprising, right? This is happening around the world, even in the West. And even in India, there are conversations about these things, right? So I don't think that that is something that is unusual. The state needs to has realized, as it has in the rest of the world, that tech companies have an enormous amount of power. And in China, conventionally, over the sort of last decade and a half or so, what we've seen is that these technology companies have worked with the state on key deliverables. So poverty alleviation, rural credit, a lot of these things, you know, this regulators and the state has generally sort of stepped back and said, you guys can grow, you guys can expand, and you're serving this broader need. And at the same time, you've seen intense competition between technology companies in China. I mean, if you go and read Kai-Fu Lee's book, AI Superpowers, it sort of talks about this gladiatorial mentality between technology companies that are competing for IP, products, market share. And the objective is that you become so large in market share that you become essentially too big to fail, and you become fundamental to the state's deliverables of its objectives, and then you sort of are largely secure, and also you can manipulate the market. And that's where I think what's happening right now is happening, right? You know, there's been a phrase that's been used a couple of times in sort of Chinese discussion about the growth of private capital in the last couple of months. And that's about, you know, preventing capital from, and I'm quoting this, expanding in a disorderly fashion. This is sort of linked to the anti-monopoly conversation that's happening in China. So, I mean, I look at it largely in this context, but of course, what's happening with Jack Ma right now cannot be devoid of politics. And in that, I think we need to sort of go back to looking at how his fall sort of starts to happen, if I can call it a fall, because it's really not a fall at the moment. We still need much more information. But how sort of things started to precipitate in late October. And I think that's where we need to start. But even before that, I mean, I know that you've read his biography. You've sort of followed his work. His was this inspirational story, right? It was a story about somebody coming from nowhere to create this big empire and, you know, in communist China to be able to do that. And it sort of gave you this sense of how entrepreneurship can thrive in China, how, you know, somebody can dream and dream big and create a big business, how regulators can be open to such creations. And that story of Jack Ma being this, you know, character to be as somebody, as, you know, whom people can aspire to be, you know, like that story is today deeply, deeply dented. But I sort of come back to you to tell us a little bit about sort of how Jack Ma rose to this position that he is at.
I mean, it's really interesting, this whole Jack Ma story, because what basically happens here is that this guy is a serial entrepreneur. He's starting and failing businesses, I think there's two or three. And like, he goes to the US and he's one of the first few people in China to realize the potential of the internet. And he comes back to China and he begins this company called Alibaba. It's called Alibaba, well, because it's, the book had some logic. It was basically that the story of Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, it's sort of like a cultural archetype. And so this would relate. And so he starts this company, and he just deals with Masayoshi-san of SoftBank. The most interesting thing to me about all of that story is that Ant Financial is sort of not involved in the deals with SoftBank. So Ant Financial basically is Alipay, the company that owns Alipay. And it's basically China's payment system, if I'm not wrong. I'm hesitant to sort of take leaps here, but you can correct me, Manoj. But it's like, it's basically like Paytm or Google Pay for China, or like both of them combined for China, right? And so Jack basically has the most equity in Alipay. Like Alibaba is basically like split between, I think, SoftBank and Jack and maybe Yahoo, I'm not entirely sure. But and Financial is basically a whole different ballgame. And so he becomes extremely big, I think too big to fail, as you said. And then there's a speech that he makes, which is, throughout his life, he's dealt with regulators. He's a public figure. He's clashed with them before. And I think that would have continued or will continue when the antitrust stuff sort of takes speed in China. But this time around, I think he's basically crossed the line that he maybe shouldn't have. And basically, I'll ask you to elaborate on the speech because I don't know enough about it. But he basically disses the party more than he should have, right?
Yeah, I mean, let's just go back to some of these things. Like, you know, what does Ant Financial really do? I mean, you're partly right. Like, you know, it's partly the sort of payment system where it's just sort of supposed the payment gateway. But it's much more than that. And that's part of the problem from the new sort of anti-monopoly rules, right? Ant Financial, you know, it connects, apart from just sort of that payment gateway of Alipay, it also sort of connects about 100 banks in China with consumers and small businesses who need short-term loans. And that is increasingly been a source of problem for regulators, particularly, you know, with these short-term loans to consumers being used for all sorts of crazy purchases, and also then eventually the sort of the loan sharks that can come associated with it. So there are two sort of credit businesses of Alipay, which are Huapei, which means just spend, and Chiepei, which means just borrow. And this sort of provides loans to millions of people across the country. Banks underwrite this debt and take the credit risk and collect the interest payments also, while Ant sort of collects just the facilitating charges to do all of this. So the risk is with the bank. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Ant also provides sort of has tie-ups with asset managers across the country, including mutual funds, insurers, securities firms, and so on and so forth. And it provides these investment solutions to lots of the users of Alipay. So now the other issue here is that you're providing all these products and there's no real risk that you're taking essentially. And that's another problem for regulators. And therefore, when they were talking about these new rules, what they were essentially saying was that, look, we might need to keep some sort of the liability, particularly given the sort of debt challenges that China has. Small banks in China, small and large banks actually, but particularly the small banks in China, which are regional banks, are really vulnerable to debt issues. If you just go back about a year and a half or so, I no longer can say last year because last year was 2020, but 2019, if you just go back to 2019, what you will see is that there were a string of local bank failures in China. And in some ways, the government tried to disassociate itself from these failures, saying that, okay, these banks can fail and it's fine. But at the end of the day, they did sort of, the People's Bank of China did step in to restructure some of these loans. So given these sort of debt issues and the credit risks in banks, and the political priority of maintaining financial risks, because that's the key sort of challenge for the stability of the party also and the broader stability of the economy, it links to then these sort of payment gateways, given the sort of size of all of this, right? Ant sort of serves about 70% of Alipay, serves about 70% of the Chinese market, which is a huge, huge number. So the sort of stability risk of something like this, which is so intertwined into multiple businesses, is something that is challenging. So that's the first thing to keep in mind about Alipay and Ant Financial. The second thing is Jack Ma's speech, and we'll link the speech in the show notes. Right, he goes to this the Bund Summit in Shanghai, and he delivers a speech over there. And if anybody who's followed Jack Ma's career, what you would have seen is that there's lots of folksy anecdotes, commentaries that he usually sort of dishes out. I mean, the idea is that he doesn't talk like a suit, if I could use that word. He doesn't give you numbers, details, whatever. It's a lot of sort of folksy knowledge, anecdotes from his life, and so on and so forth. And he's, in many ways, it can be, he can be very charming. And there can be a lot of sort of self-deprecation while making a lot of these very biting comments about the system. As somebody who succeeded in that sort of a system, you understand where the sort of problems lie, and you also understand how do you get your interests furthered without actually trying to, ruffle too many feathers. But this time it seems like he did ruffle too many feathers. So this is October 24th last year in 2020. He's at the Bund Summit and he gives this speech where he essentially quotes President Xi Jinping a couple of times, which is not necessarily the smartest thing to do unless you're quoting him in tremendous support for him. And he then talks about the banking system in China. And he has really biting comments about the banking system. And I'm going to quote some of what he said, right? This is the English translation of his speech is available on Apple's Daily's website. And he says this, right? Finance is credit management in nature. We must do away with the, quote, pawn shop mentality of today's finance. We must rely on the development of a credit system. Banks today are still a continuation of the pawn shop mentality. A pawn shop is about pledges and collaterals. In the old days, a pawn shop was an advanced idea. Had it not been for innovations such as pledges and collaterals, there would be no financial institutions today, and the Chinese economy would have not developed over the past 40 years to such a point. However, given the nature of assets and collaterals, they can take us to an extreme if we rely on them. And then he sort of talks about why this pawn shop mentality affects entrepreneurs and how there is so much focus on risk that you're not looking at rewards. And that is the bit that really, really gets regulators riled up. And this is not a summit where he sort of, it's not an obscure thing. The Chinese vice president is in attendance here. Wang Qishan is in attendance here. And it essentially, like I said, ruffles a lot of feathers. And very soon you start to see, Xi Jinping take action. Again, like I said, quoting him was not the greatest of things to do. And he does that a couple of times in that speech. That then leads to sort of, and I'm now sort of going to tell you a little bit from a Wall Street Journal report, because obviously a lot of this is reported information, given that there is very little information that's directly that comes out on these issues in China. But essentially, the Wall Street Journal then reported that what happened was that in late October, you had Xi Jinping and his economic czar, Liu He, whom I'm sure people are familiar with because he's been part of the public negotiations with the Trump administration of the last couple of years with regard to the U.S.-China trade war. They sort of convened for a meeting on October 31st, and they sort of put together some sort of, detailed structure of how do you sort of tackle the growing power of these tech firms, particularly Alibaba and Ant Financial. At the meeting of this Financial Stability and Development Committee, they issue a statement. The statement essentially says that they will put all kinds of activities under regulation and treat the same businesses the same way. This was essentially looking at Ant, that if you're part of one particular business, you can't be doing multiple things. And your regulation around you need to be very similar. And soon after that, we sort of start to get Chinese regulators knocking at the doors of these companies. They issue these new rules for lending by firms like Ant. And those rules essentially say this. And this is where Jack Ma's criticism sort of, aligns with all of this. He talks about collaterals and asset depositing of assets. And the new rules say this, that, companies like Ant, which are doing this kind of lending, will need to fund at least 30% of each loan that it makes in conjunction with banks. So you can no longer just sit back and say that I am a technology services solutions provider. No, you are a financial firm. You need to put your money where your mouth is. You can't just say that I'm linking banks and individuals and I have no role to play in this and I'm just going to collect transaction fees. You are going to be pledging your own money there and 30% of what is what you need to pledge. Now, that obviously is not necessarily welcomed by large sections of the industry that's involved in this. And, you know, subsequently in early November, you have November 2nd, if I'm correct, you have regulators knocking in on, you know, all the different firms, including Alibaba and AntPay and Financial. And you ended up having this sort of lengthy regulatory meeting, which gets reported across the world, where, you know, people are talking to these guys about what the new rules entail, what their businesses are, how they should be running things, and so on and so forth. This gets again reported about, you know, how, you know, this sort of created an issue. Of course, and Financial by then has realized that things are going to get problematic. And that's because towards the end of October, it was gearing for a mega, mega IPO, an IPO that investors had already sort of largely picked up on. It was expected to raise around $34 to $35 billion, which could end up making Ant Financial's valuation in excess of around $300 billion. So that would make it among the most valuable technology companies in the world. Essentially, these new rules, the way they come in, what happens, leads to the plug being pulled on this IPO. And even today, we don't have further details. So the people who sort of pledged money, who've committed money, continue to be stuck because they don't know what to do going forward. And that's a huge, huge problem. So that's essentially how the story sort of unfolded. I think a lot of people look at it and say that this is a political takedown. I think there's some sort of truth to that, that there is a political takedown that's happening. But I think there's also some sort of truth to the fact that this is not just about Jack Ma or Ant Financial or Alibaba. This is actually about a broader systemic overhaul at one end of which is, you know, just restraining the power of technology companies. Because if you look at changes in the Chinese tech regulatory ecosystem over the last couple of months itself, ever since the fifth plenary session, which was held in late October, you will see that there have been no more regulations, tighter, stricter rules on privacy. And again, people don't talk about privacy in China's context, but there have been stricter rules on privacy which have come out. There is new regulation. There's a new regulation on anti-monopoly practices, which was issued by the State Administration for Market Regulation, which is a key regulator. And these guidelines on anti-monopoly in the platform economy were put in public domain on November 10th. And then they'll be eventually put out. The feedback was used till November 30th. So they had a 20-day comment period before they then adopted this stuff. And they essentially talk about, you know, something very similar to what we are seeing happening in the West, or the conversations, at least in India also, about how these large firms tend to monopolize the marketplace, tend to restrict sales for different entities that they want to restrict new technological development, can even lead to sort of boycotting transactions of different enterprises, and the sort of power that they have, and how do you sort of cut down that power. So that's how the story so far has unfolded. This business about nationalization, I mean, I'm a little surprised that this comes up. But what we do know is that, you know, there have been some conversations, and particularly in late December, what we did hear was that the deputy governor of the People's Bank of China, China Central Bank, Pan Gongsheng, he spoke about how there were corporate governance issues in Alibaba, in Ant Financial. And they needed to sort of go back to their origins and become a payment service provider, like you mentioned, and therefore move away from these other things and break down the sort of linkages between these other services that was being a part of, break down your businesses and separate them. So that's as far as what we know publicly in terms of what they want to do. At the moment, what Ant Financial is, the Ant Group essentially said that it is, and this is very sort of Chinese political language, they said that they would be establishing a rectification working group, you know, and with the aim of implementing the requirements laid out by the regulator. So there's still some sort of a process going on. My best guess of how this will eventually unfold is not nationalization, but you will see firewalls created, if not separate entities created between the different businesses that will impact the sector as a whole. But my sense is that you're going to see far more, far stricter sort of risk management regulation in China, financial risk management regulation. And I think this is part of it is also about that.
Okay, thanks. I have one question and one observation. Okay, I'll go to my observation first, right? And this is my cynical take on this. Tell me how much of this I'm getting wrong. So Jack Ma got into, how do I say this, in a family-friendly podcast way. Jack Ma got into a power measuring contest with Xi Jinping and then lost. And now you can't find him. Is this basically the very crude summary of what just happened?
So, I mean, I think I wouldn't sort of say it as that. I mean, I think that there is utility of entrepreneurs from a political point of view, but there is also an increasing sort of political mood in China led by the leadership of Xi Jinping to try and make sure that private capital is also subservient to the party's objectives. And I think that is how we should be looking at this. So there is, in part, this is about the regulating the market, because the market can create certain kinds of risks which can be politically undesirable. And we need to understand financial sector in China from that point of view. It's not just about, I mean, you see this in India, right? You know, when banks fail, suddenly there can be political consequences for governments in India also. In China, it's not just about this sort of market collapse having political consequences for a government, because there's no a government, it's one party. So the political consequences are collapse. And it could go sort of as far as collapse, or it could at least cause sort of, you know, weakening of political power of the leader. And I think that's something that's unacceptable. So that's one of these contexts is that. The other context is that, well, you do need to regulate this market. You know, this entire system has grown unregulated, largely unregulated, or at least weakly regulated, because you wanted it to grow. That's led to significant risk. I mean, a few years ago, the entire P2P lending system in China collapsed. You know, if you go back and read stories at that point of time, what you will see is that these depositors, these people who lent money, they are filling, you know, sports stadiums, protesting. If not protesting, then, you know, companies are sort of set up booths where they're calling these people to discuss how they can be sort of, how their money can be salvaged. You don't want to see that sort of chaos again, because that sort of chaos can be politically damaging from a Chinese leadership point. So one part of it is this. That, you know, there is a systemic regulation that's needed. Secondly, there's a political implication of systemic or financial risks. And Xi Jinping has been quite clear about this, right? In 2017, when the 19th Party Congress happened, curtailing systemic risks, financial risk was one of the three priorities that he outlined. And just tells you a little bit about the sense of concern with regard to this. The third is that, yes, you know, you don't want people growing too big for their boots. Particularly entrepreneurs. And that's where I think Jack Ma sort of finally fell foul, you know, of Xi Jinping. And again, I think the mood across the year, if I just take you a little bit earlier into 2020, there were a couple of occasions where Xi Jinping spoke about the need for entrepreneurs to be patriotic. And then eventually there was a set of, you know, regulatory principles, whatever, guidelines outlined for how entrepreneurs need to be patriotic and serve national causes. And increasingly, if you sort of go back and see, and this is some great data that's been put together by Neil Thomas from Macropolo, where he shows the number of China's top 500 private firms participating in what are called national strategies. And he has data going through the number of years. But if you go back from 2016, out of the top 500, 384 were participating. To 2019, where you have 471 of the 500 participating. So it sort of tells you a little bit about how the significance of private capital in pursuing government outlined priorities has increased. Now, in that environment, if you have somebody who seems like a maverick, you might want to sort of, you know, crack down on them. So that's how I would look at the entire sort of power measuring analogy that you've shared. But the other thing that I would sort of keep in mind is that there is systemic tech sector regulation that's changing in China. And I think the Chinese government also sees it as an opportunity to make sure that things work according to their desires. And this is a bit of a power struggle with not just Jack Ma, but also the entire sort of big tech sector in China. You know, so I think that's partly what's going on.
Thanks. I think the final question I have here, Manoj, is what sort of timeline are we looking at when it comes to regulation in antitrust, data protection, and this particular financial regulation? Because in the Western world or in India, this thing has been going on for the better part of a decade, if not more. So what kind of outcomes and when are we looking at a closing date for having some sort of regulation, at least in antitrust or in financial? Yeah.
So I think it's really difficult to put a timeline in place. My sense is that you will see far more happening within this year, how legislation is passed. Okay, so you might have regulators creating guidelines, which is not an issue, which happens at its own pace. But how legislation is usually passed in China is, and it, again, it depends, right? You know, there are rounds of public consultation where you invite feedback, but there is also cases where, you know, you go through things extremely quickly. And the Chinese, the national security law with regard to Hong Kong is one example of this, right? It was announced and within less than a month, you had the legislation cleared. So it depends on what priority is being pushed. But my sense is that through this year, you will see technology sector antitrust regulation moving extremely fast. How this happens is that you usually have a bi-monthly meeting of the National People's Congress, is the parliament essentially. They have a standing committee which debates draft legislation. And they put out a schedule of what they are debating and what they are discussing before their meetings. And if you sort of look at that, what you will see is that increasingly there is a priority on these rules. And I think this will move much more quickly. I mean, even if it's like sort of data protection rules, what we do know is that, you know, different entities, for example, the People's Bank, just this week spoke about new regulation to try tighten oversight of businesses that collect personal and corporate credit information. So there are different sets of data. You've got a broad data regulation architecture, you've got a legislation, and now different entities are going to create their own rules and guidelines. Most of these are open for public comment. So for example, in the case of the People's Bank thing, the draft rules are open for public comment till February 10th. So you have a brief period of that, and then they get adopted with whatever changes that you may need, unless there are sort of significant changes that the government, that sort of lawmakers end up thinking that we need to make. Usually that's not necessarily the process. But there are some times where, you know, legislation can go through 3-4 rounds of review by the standing committee. So at the moment, I think the antitrust regulation is going to move much faster, as is data protection regulation, because I think China sees developing a sound technology ecosystem, particularly on issues that, say, even the West is struggling to come up with clear policies on, as critical not just to domestic economic growth, but also to projection of standards globally as what are accepted standards. So in that sense, I think you will see much quicker move on this.
Thanks for that, Manoj. I think the most fascinating thing to me about this podcast, and I think I'll end on this note, is that it's 30 minutes, but it's filled with a year's worth of insights, or at least a year's worth of research that culminates into insights. So thank you so much. Do you have any final comment, Manoj?
No, I mean, I think it's an interesting space to watch. There's lots of speculation about Jack Ma being missing, and some of that sort of, you know, for some of the sort of commentators, it harks back to, you know, how in the last couple of years, you had previous sort of fallen tycoons, Anbang Insurance Group's Wu Xiaohui, or Tomorrow Group's Xiao Qianhua. Those folks also went missing before their empires went through breakups. At the moment, the fact is, the honest truth is that we don't really know what's happening behind the scenes. From what we hear from sources that get again reported with regard to close to Jack Ma is that, you know, he's just laying low, which makes perfect sense. You know, you would want to lay low, and why would, particularly when your public appearance caused such a stir and cost you essentially a record IPO. So I think you would want to stay low. I think the bigger takeaway is that, you know, politics is an extremely important component of any business in China. And I think one needs to think of it that way. This is also Beijing sort of sending a message to entrepreneurs saying that you need to fall in line, which might not be the greatest thing from the point of view of entrepreneurship in China, right? But this is Beijing basically telling entrepreneurs that politics comes first. And you need to serve your political masters primarily. You can do that by growth, but, you know, we will decide how the sector essentially grows. So that just tells you a little bit about the differences between the Chinese regulatory environment and, you know, in sort of other places. But I think it's an interesting space to watch. We still don't know how this will all play out. But I would be very, very surprised if you're going to see nationalization or anything like that. What you're going to see likely is some sort of firewalls being created, and perhaps Jack Ma will sort of come out a bit more humbled. He's not an old man, he's just 56, although he's technically retired, but I think you sort of see him coming back perhaps a little bit more humbled, but coming back nonetheless.
Alright, thanks for that. Time will tell how this shapes up. Until then, we'll keep an eye on China. Alright, thank you.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, Don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.